This episode of Midori House was first broadcast on the 3rd of June 2015 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Tuck. Coming up on today's programme, as Western and Arab states battling Islamic State back Iraq's plan to retake territory from the militants, we ask if planning for the fight against IS is taking a turn for the better. My guests, Shashank Yoshi and Robert Fox, are here to give their views. And as business, government and civil society leaders gather in Cape Town for the 25th World Economic Forum on Africa, we ask what challenges face the continent as it looks to the coming decades. Also ahead, trouble at the top in the world of football.
I have thoroughly considered my presidency, thought about my presidency and about the last 40 years of my life. These years were closely related to FIFA and this wonderful sport of football.
So, not so invincible after all. After FIFA's president steps down just days after his re-election, we discuss the latest claims of corruption engulfing world's football's governing body. That's all to come right here on Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. So, welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Shashank Yoshi, the Research Fellow at the Royal United Services Institute, or RUSI, and Robert Fox, who's the Defence Editor at the Evening Standard newspaper here in London. Welcome both to the programme. Now, we're going to start today's show with the fight against Islamic State. Yesterday in Paris, Western and Arab states conducting airstrikes against the jihadist movement backed a plan by Iraq to retake territory from the group. It came after Prime Minister al-Abadi criticised coalition members for not doing enough to help the Baghdad government push back the insurgents. Islamic State has lately made gains in Iraq despite the US-led coalition strikes. But after yesterday's meeting, it seems there's a new sense of a winning strategy emerging. Could this be the winning one we need? Shashank, let's start with this. So the Americans are saying we have a winning strategy now, that in fact the tide is turning in our direction. We've killed 10,000 people. Is it all just wishful thinking?
Well, it's rather dispiriting to see US officials wheel out body counts of all things as an indication that they're winning. Those with longer memories than me might remember Vietnam-era body counts and how successful those proved as a measure of success. US strategy is a little bit like the Black Knight in Monty Python, which has suffered setback after setback, yet insists it's only a small flesh wound, nothing, you know, fatal here. Actually, the fall of Ramadi is catastrophic. The gains in Syria are really, really troubling. And I think if the US isn't willing to acknowledge it has a problem and has to do something, although I don't think that something should include troops, this will still get worse.
So what that line coming out from the US, that this discussion yesterday has led to a kind of, a new willingness to sort things out. Is it all just, why are they making these public announcements when anybody looking at the facts can see that it's not quite true?
I think they have to project momentum in confidence. They know that this is a battle of wills. This is partly a PR battle as well for the Iraqi people's popularity, for Sunni hearts and minds within Iraq, to hold a coalition together amongst the Gulf states who think America should be doing more in Syria. They can't accept that they might be losing. And I think Ashton Carter really gave their inner feelings away last week when he said he didn't have faith in the Iraqi army's will to fight. An extraordinary thing for a US defense secretary to say of his primary ally. I think that's his real belief. The confidence coming out of the Paris meeting is a mask over that, because no one really wants to have to escalate in a way that would put more Western troops in harm's way.
Robert, there's no doubt that the Western governments would like to see IS pushed out of Iraq, and they're doing what they can with airstrikes. But they just don't seem to be effective. And as Shashank was saying, on the ground, if you have Iraqi troops that seem less than keen to fight, it seems impossible that this battle can be won at this time.
I think the American camp can't make up its mind, one, what ISIS-IS really is, and two, what they want, what the strategic end state is going to be of this whole game. What do they want to be in Sunnistan? in Iraq, in Anbar, Diyala, places like that. Because, as you rightly say, the common denominator is that Britain, America, and France do not want to put troops on the ground in number in the way that would be required to really galvanize the Iraqi National Army at the moment.
And the Iraqis don't want that either, by the way.
Yeah. Because that would play into the ISIS propaganda machine. And as Shashank said, so much of this is about propaganda. But when you get such diverse opinion as that being expressed by General David Petraeus, who still enjoys the status of being a guru on this, saying this is a battle of ideas, this is a battle of political wills, this is why we must engage with them politically. Well, actually, looking at his record, for all his great skill and his great understanding at times, he didn't succeed in that respect, either in his tenure in Iraq or in Afghanistan. So, what do you do? On the other hand, I just want to mention a British general, rather distinguished, who worked for Petraeus, Lieutenant General Graham Lamb, now retired, Director of Special Forces, who was very much involved in the so-called Anbar Awakening. He and a very skilled, experienced British diplomat, both in Iraq and Afghanistan, as it turned out, Sir William Patey, were on the radio yesterday. And it's very interesting how they concluded there would have to be force, and there would have to be Western force light involved in this. You could only get Iraqis to fight if you had trainers, in quotes, and this is very much a special forces solution. By the way, it's nonsense, because you're never going to have the right kind of number, you're never going to have the sustainability, you're never going to be there for long enough. As if they could fight with them, then perhaps they might stand a chance of recovering Ramadi and the one that they've aimed at, which I think is right off the agenda for this year, probably for next, Mosul. You can see what a complete muddle we're in. But actually, more than Petraeus's pronouncement to the BBC, gave a long interview, was what the subtext of what the diplomat Patey and the general Lamb actually said. What they said, and they were, when Britain did have a presence there, the last people really in there with a name, and they said, well, actually, Iraq has gone. Iraq has split into three. It's going to be very difficult, and I'd be very interested to hear what Shashank has to say about this, to galvanise Shia forces to really want to go and fight for places like Mosul again, to fight for Ramadi, Fallujah, and so on, and lose in number, because I think even their Iranian sponsors would not want that. We're in a real mess. You've got an impasse there, and I will shut up in a minute, because then you've got another picture, which is moving very fast now, I suspect, faster than we are understanding in the news media in Syria. Just as I came into the studio, there were reports of desperate use of crude chemical weapons from Assad regime helicopters. There have been the reports, a bit exaggerated in the New York Times, there's collusion between ISIS, unwritten collusion between IS and the Syrian state to squeeze down and shut out the al-Qaeda elements. It's out of control. And this was the thing that we really came away from that foreign minister's meeting. They knew not of what they spake. They did not understand the facts on the ground.
We should bring Shashank back in here. There's two interesting points here. One, we don't want to attack IS too much in Syria for fear of helping the al-Assad government. So in a way, that the battle, we've got one arm tied behind our backs. And on the other side, have we been over-dependent on hoping that the Iranians would sort things out on the ground and we wouldn't have to get in and get messy?
I think we have ceded the narrative ground to the Iranians, who've projected the image to Iraqis that they are the ones who are really on Iraq's side, who are really providing the manpower, the muscle, the support, and that we, the flaky Westerners, are secretly... I mean, a surprising number of Iraqis believe we, the West, back ISIS. A shocking number, actually. You cannot win a war on that basis. A great many of them are inflamed or infuriated by comments like that of Ashton Carter, whereas the Iranians say, ah, well, the Americans criticise you, we help you. So I don't think we've been over-dependent on the Iranians.
But the Iranians haven't been successful at that successful on the ground.
No, but they've managed to convince the Iraqis they are, and that's the key point. You're absolutely right. When it was the Shia militias who came to take Tikrit, they couldn't. They failed. They required American support. Do most Iraqis know that? Do they understand that? Absolutely not. The perception is Iran was first to the scene, and it's going to be there long after the Americans leave. That's an enormous problem that the Americans will have. I would also say, in addition to these big issues, there are some small, easily resolvable issues. In Ramadi, the use of suicide car bombs was a major tactical success for ISIS. Absolutely. In overcoming superior Iraqi forces. What works against suicide car bombs? Anti-tank missiles. The Kurds have lots of them. The Iraqi troops in Anbar don't. Why? Well, a failure of strategy somewhere along the way. The supply chain has broken. These are easily resolvable issues. It's not just will to fight. It's not just morale. It's basic things like this. So someone on the American side is messing up.
And Robert, when you look at the situation briefly, do you feel we'll be in the same situation in a year's time, in 2 years' time, that, as you say, they have taken this territory, it's not going to be possible to budge them?
Absolutely not. We're not going to be in the same position, because I follow exactly what Shashank was saying. Because if you look at it, Assad's forces are becoming exhausted. Let's start with that. I remember when we were NATO tank spotters in the Cold War, you would talk about track mileage. Even in the Russian occupation or the Russian intervention in Afghanistan, it's track mileage. It's when the tracks of vehicles actually run out of miles. You can only run them for X hundred miles, any military vehicle. And it's particularly so with helicopters, rotor systems, gearboxes, things like that. I can see them coming to their limit there. So that is a major factor. It's very interesting who knows how to fight and who is prepared to fight. Undoubtedly, elements of IS really do have that capability, but so too have the Kurds, the legatees of the PKK, who fight harder than any other Kurdish element. These are largely Syrian and Turkish Kurds, and they are very, very tough. I think it's going to break down. It's going to fragment. I think Syria is going to be a terrible mess. But I think that one of the things where we see the, after all the false dawns of the Arab Spring, is we are seeing an epoch-making collapse of governance in whole areas, or a sense of governance of the Arab world. And I think a year from now, that will be more than ever apparent.
Shashank, do you think if we get what we wished for and the Assad government is in an endgame, it does fall, is that just going to clear the whole of Syria for ISIS?
I think ISIS will be the actor best placed to exploit it. But of course, let's not forget Jabhat al-Nusra, presently al-Qaeda's front inside Syria, is very confident and very powerful. Its leader just gave an interview on Al Jazeera last week where, you know, the leader of a Al-Qaeda front appearing on Al Jazeera boasting about his success, being treated deferentially by this television station. And there's lots of talk about countries like Qatar trying to rehabilitate Nusra, pull it away from Al-Qaeda, use it against Assad. So, no, it isn't just ISIS. But you said, will we get what we want? I think at this stage, most Western countries want Assad to go, but they do not want the Syrian regime to fall into pieces. And so if and when that moment of reckoning that Robert talked about comes, I think we're going to see some very urgent diplomacy between Moscow, Washington, and Tehran,
absolutely,
to say, look, Assad is going. We don't want the state to collapse. Let's now work on the peace plan or transition we have failed to achieve for the past 4 years. Let's find the Syrian generals, or at least colonels, we can work with. Call off Hezbollah from these places. We'll try and restrain Nusra in these places. And really, it may or may not work, but certainly we don't want to see the state crumble. If it does, that will be a generational shift in the region.
Well, we're going to move on now and look at a story of what difference does a warship or two make? That's a question facing France after tensions between Russia and the West put the brakes on a deal in which Moscow was to purchase two French-built helicopter carriers. The intended deal stems from Nicolas Sarkozy's decision back in 2011 to make the West's first major arms deal sale one to Russia since the fall of the USSR. But events in Ukraine mean that they'll just have to wait a little while. Meanwhile, Paris is left trying to save face. Robert, how did we get in this mess?
Well, I think you named it. It's Monsieur Sarkozy, showing that he could break the mold and could trade with the Russians, and George W. Bush, no less, said he looked into Putin's eyes and here was a man he could trust. He didn't use the Thatcher formula for Gorbachev, but it is very difficult. And particularly these ships, the Mistral class, which are formidable helicopter carriers, and therefore they're very good at close inshore operations. And we've had, in fact, I've spoken on Monocle about it. The Swedes are desperately worried about this kind of stuff, and it really would be red rag to a bull. But it's poor old France being caught at its game. Defence sales and entrepreneurship, actually, they think entrepreneurship is, of course, based on a French word. I mean, they've been selling Rafale aircraft all over the place, and these things have consequences, and it's very difficult. And across Western Europe, of course, defence is in great crisis. The instinct, whether it's in Berlin, London, or Paris, is to cut, 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 whereas there is now a real demand for regeneration because, I don't say threat so much as real uncertainty, is something coming so close to home, whether it's people cannot catch the tiger by its tail with Putin's Russia. They're not sure whether it's Putin, whether it's his military, or whether it's Russia and the political entity of Russia as a whole. There is the problem of the Mediterranean. There's the problem of the crisis of what we have just been talking about with IS and refugees and so on, and the collapse of whole areas of around the Horn of Africa, Yemen and so on, pouring into the Mediterranean. Is it just a humanitarian crisis? Could it have a political complexion? The Italians say yes, because there are now signs of entrism of IS agents trying to get into migrant ships and so on. This is not a time when, as in the UK, they were suggesting, the leading partner in the coalition government at the turn of the year, now in a majority, the Conservatives were saying, oh, we could contemplate up to 12% in the cut in the defence budget. The word around Whitehall now to say this is that defence is ring-fenced. And this is where France is, but France doesn't have the money to find the armed forces and the equipment that it really requires.
Well, Shashank, you know, the decision not to sell ships to Russia was, it seemed wise and sensible at the time. And, you know, it looks like it kind of left France with a bit of a problem, because now the Russians are saying even if sanctions are listed, they probably don't want them, thank you very much, and we just want our money back.
Plus compensation. Quite a lot.
But at the end of it, France really didn't have an option, did they?
No, they didn't. Although they really were dragged into this kicking and screaming. They really wanted to sell these ships. And the reason why is France has a very different attitude to arms sales than we do.
They did too.
They did. They don't have the same squeamishness we do in this country. They will sell to anyone. They've just sold lots of planes to, you know, Al-Sisi's Egypt. That's their reputation, to do these deals without worrying about their hands getting dirty. And that helps them. It helps them flog kit to countries who are worried about whether we'll be a goody two-shoes and sell them parts if there's a war on. No one worries about whether France will. They'll do anything. So France had a reputation at stake. This is why they were worried about this, and that's why they were so reluctant. Yeah. Now, what do they do? Well, it's costing them about 5 million euros a month, so that's a reasonable amount of money. You know, the ships, plus the sailors, the training, you can't just give, even you couldn't give this to a small country because it would wash out their navy. They wouldn't be able to run it. So I think France should look at India. I think India's a country that has big naval ambitions. It's a country that's expanding its defence relationship with France. It's very interested in warships like this that are capable of projecting power quite far away. It also has one of the very few growing defence budgets in the world. I think a France-India sale is something that should be looked at much more carefully.
Well, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Tuck, and my guest today, Shashank Joshi, and also Robert Fox. Come out next, we're going to discuss the 25th World Economic Forum in Africa.
Culture with me, Robert Bound, at half an hour is now shorter, sweeter, new and improved. Where else can you end up informed and entertained after half an hour? By watching a quarter of Oscar-winning The Theory of Everything, by reading the first 20 pages of Kazuo Ishiguro's new novel, by speedwalking through a thousandth of the Venice Biennale, not on your Nelly. Culture with Robert Bound, smaller and even more perfectly formed.
This is what people do for a living, right? They put their shows on. This is the show of shows.
Culture premieres at 1900 hours London time on Mondays.
And welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Still with me are Shashank Joshi and also Robert Fox. Now, for our next item, we're going to Cape Town, where the 25th World Economic Forum on Africa is getting underway. Under the heading, Then and Now, Reimagining Africa's Future, it's a moment for regional and global leaders from business, government and civil society to take stock of change on the continent. Shashank, these talking forums are always kind of useful. I guess deals get done and there are some conversations that happen off stage. But it's a tough moment for Africa. We see the migration issue. We've just come out of Ebola. Not quite the confidence story that Africa would want to be projecting at this time.
Well, no single story, obviously. I spent 4 months last year driving down from Addis Ababa down to Cape Town. And so I saw a sort of pretty big cross section. And, you know, somewhere like Addis is absolutely booming and connected to completely different markets. But I think within South Africa, yeah, they're in a real psychological slump. I was there for the election. You had the ANC win, but only just or at least lose some of their massive majority. You're seeing corruption allegations and issues around Zuma's personal conduct. But much more fundamentally than that, the economic gloss has come off. You know, countries that you were once looking at South Africa alongside, like India and China, well, they're growing 5+%. South African growth has just slumped. You've got unemployment at 25%. I think there's sort of a lot of angst and existential questions about where did that go? How do we get it back? And are we in the midst of simultaneously of a political slump, an economic slump, and not in South Africa, but in other parts of Africa, a serious, serious security challenge that is getting worse and worse.
Now, it's not, and just sticking with you for a second, it's not particularly only an African continent story, but for developing nations, they still are struggling to find the model for distribution of wealth. So, you know, that many countries, you know, are doing super well, like Angola, but the distribution of wealth there isn't great. Same in South Africa, still this kind of disparity between you know, the people doing the hard graft and a small elite kind of gathering the wealth. Is that one narrative that does need to be addressed, do you think?
It needs to be addressed. And to take South Africa as an example of it, it was a serious issue in the election. You had very populist, left-wing, radical politicians who came into the election and put serious challenges to these big ruling elites. But of course, the problem is both economic and political, and those elites, the same factors and structures allow them to skim this stuff off from the state, also helps them win elections and stay in power. And you know, you see that in Angola, you see it in Nigeria, you see it in many, well, Nigeria obviously is a slightly different story now, but in many other places. Unless you fix the politics, these rent-seeking elites who monopolize those resources are, you know, going to be able to keep maintaining that position of privilege.
Robert, when you look at these events, do you feel that they're useful, especially for a continent like Africa?
I think it's useful for probably the net winners in all this, like China. I was at a wedding in the Netherlands at the weekend, and I spoke to a lady who'd been a minister in the Dutch government. She now works essentially for think tanks paid for by China. And she was going to the World Economic Forum, and she was going to interview 50 CEOs of leading African multinationals. She wasn't going to interview them on her behalf. She was interviewing them on behalf of banks and institutions for whom she works in Shanghai. And I think this tells you an awful lot of what's going on. It's so much now that China seems to be really offering opportunity, investment, for the obvious returns. And I think what I fear, though, is that Africa's hiatus or pause, as Shashank described it, is probably the outsider's opportunity. There are huge problems, as we say. I mean, the thing that really hits the headlines every time are the questions of governance, infrastructure, social cohesion, particularly in West Africa now. Gone for a time being is the optimism projected by people like Tony Blair. Do you remember he wrote an article, I think, signed article unusually for The Economist, saying, oh, Africa is the continent of the first half of the 21st century. Well, you're not hearing that now.
Well, we don't have much time left. I said, no, we both all want to rather get in the final story, which is the revelation that Sepp Blatter is under investigation by the US authorities. It's prompted even louder calls for the wholesale reform of the troubled FIFA. Shashank, when you look at this as a story of development, you know, today there are lots of claims, you know, by Qatar, this is, you know, you know, what's going on is just an act of racism, and you know, this is an attempt by the West to kind of steal back.
Well, I call the Ali G card for Qatar.
Yes. What do you make of the FIFA story from your perspective?
I think, on the one hand, it's a clear-cut story of a highly venal, corrupt elite, but the subtext is, if that was all there was, it wouldn't be that interesting. It's the fact that it's embedded in a sort of what we once used to call sort of North-South conflict. And there's a reason why Blatt is around. It's not just because he rules using tanks or because, you know, he's sort of tortures his opponent. It's because he has a lock on a very large amount of developing and small countries who benefit from this. And what's interesting is you have the intersection of these big geopolitical disputes with this footballing dispute. You have Putin coming out and supporting Blatter. But even within Europe, I think we have all really forgotten that Spain and France both voted for Blatter. There are divisions within Europe in dealing with a major external challenge in this way, which sounds like so many other issues we're facing. So I think this is a, you know, a question about how other organizations in countries like China, Russia, India, the Caribbean, Latin America are going to sit back and watch. They're not just going to watch as one of their key patrons is toppled and replaced with some sort of Jordanian stooge or something. They will fight this. And I think we're now going to see a battle for the soul of FIFA. And it's certainly not going to fall into our laps, into, you know, Michel Platini and UEFA's vision of what it should be.
Robert, when you look at this story, today 400 people at FIFA stood up when Mr. Blatter came back to the headquarters and applauded him for 10 minutes of standing ovation. What's going on?
I've been following it on my favourite soccer website, Bleacher Report, and one guy anonymously said, wouldn't you stand up and cheer for a whole day if somebody like that made you a millionaire overnight? Look, I think we're only at the beginning of this story. I want to know what the Department of Justice really knows. This is the biggest mafia investigation in history. And it's a money laundering operation that the anti-mafia investigators that I've known, brave men who fell in their task like Borsellino and Falcone, could not have dreamed of things being on this scale, because that's what's going on. It is a giant spin dryer washing machine of money laundering, of patronage, which we have known has been in the global soccer game ever since soccer went big, big money. My friend Tom Bauer, who's written about it, it is polluted. It's bound to be polluted because the figures are absolutely enormous. But politically, I'll bring it right down to earth, I think far more significant than whether they take the World Cup away from Qatar, and if it goes from Qatar, I'll bet it goes to Saudi Arabia, where I happen to know inside information from the construction business, they're building 10 stadia to international specifications as we speak. As we speak. But it's, if they take it from Russia, kaboom. Wait for that. Where is Vladimir going to send his Spetsnaz? Is he going to send it into FIFA headquarters in Zurich? That will cause, no, seriously, a major diplomatic geopolitical row.
Shashank, what's fascinating is, you know, that we get so, everyone's been so concerned about the Snowden reports and, you know, US snooping, but suddenly everyone really rather likes it. Everyone likes the fact that the Americans have been the ones brave enough to dive in. Do you think it kind of puts a good light on the world of FBI and the little bit of snooping on what the Europeans are doing?
Well, this is my earlier point. It's wonderful to see the long arm of American justice take down a sort of, you know, mobster figure. However, this is not what it looks like in large chunks of the world. This looks like yet another case of, you know, American imperialism, jurisdiction wildly stretched across the globe. And there's real resentment here as well. I think we forget that at our peril sitting in London if we think everyone is happy that with watching Blatter fall.
Well, how great we've had it.
He could be Al Capone's accountant at all.
The defence man and the foreign affairs man, both talking football, we love it. But we're going to have to leave it there. That was, of course, Shashank Joshi and Robert Fox. Thank you both for joining us here on Midori House today. But that is all we have time for. Today's show was produced by Alice Block. It was researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and also by Taymor Williams. And our studio manager was Chris Chilvers. For the next half hour, Tom Edwards will be keeping you company with Monocle's international playlist, on the Atlantic Shift. Then at 1900 hours, it's The Entrepreneurs with Danny Giacopelli. And at 2200 hours, it's The Monocle Daily. This show will be back at the same time tomorrow, which is 1800 hours London time. But for this edition of Midori House, from me, Andrew Tuck, goodbye.